It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. If you're a big league baseball fan, you have surely heard of the Pittsburgh Pirates. But what about the Chicago Pirates, or the Pittsburgh Burghers, or the Cleveland Infants? They were teams that were part of the Players National League of Professional Baseball Clubs, popularly known as the Players League. The league emerged in 1890 from the Brotherhood of Professional Baseball Players, the sport's first players' union. And while it lasted only one season, it made an indelible impression on the game. The Players League is the subject of a new book called The Great Baseball Revolt by Robert Ross, who is an associate professor of global cultural studies at Point Park University. And he joins us now in studio. Robert Ross, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks very much for having me. It's good to be here.
Big League Baseball in 1890 was quite a bit different from the sport that we know today. Describe how baseball grew in the decades after the Civil War and how it went from what was really a pastime to a business and eventually a big business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, baseball became popular in about the middle of the 19th century. And initially it was clubs of men, sort of social clubs who would play amongst one another, not for profit, just sort of as recreation. And then as the popularity grew with the Civil War, these clubs began to be organized into associations of clubs. And initially, the sort of founders or the gatekeepers of baseball did not want it to be a business. They didn't want it to be a for-profit enterprise. They wanted it to be this sort of gentlemanly, leisurely activity. But like many things, as it became more popular, people were willing to pay money to see the best players play. And the players wanted to get paid. And so slowly the profit incentive crept into the game. And by 1876, the National League formed as a league specifically to make baseball into a profitable business.
So baseball is luring fans to games. They're willing to pay to see the best players play. And the people that are putting up the money to organize these teams, the owners of these teams, how are they starting to view the game and their relationship with the players in terms of running their business?
Yeah, well, what hindered many investors from making any money on baseball initially was this central contradiction between the players being, on the one hand, the greatest source of revenue. People came to see the players. They didn't come to see the owners. But on the other hand, the players being the greatest cost, because the players recognized that they were the show and they asked to be paid to play. And so the owners had this conundrum of earning more and more money the better the players were, but having to pay the players more and more money the better the players were. And so it was a contradiction that was really difficult to resolve, but eventually the National League, at least for a while, did resolve it.
So how were the players treated? By the 1880s, there was starting to be some friction. The the players were starting to negotiate for a salary, which the owners would try to minimize in order to maximize their profits. So describe what was going on here and what led to this determination to leave the established National League and form their own league.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so that contradiction I talked about was really resolved mostly by the owners putting a salary cap on the players, anywhere from $1,500 to $2,500 a year. And probably most importantly, the implementation of what's called the reserve clause, which meant that once a player was on a team, he was on that team for life unless his owner was willing to sell him to another team. And so this prevented players from basically pitting teams against one another in the market to compete for who would pay this player the most amount of money. Players did not appreciate this at all because they knew they were the source of the league's profitability. They knew that without them, the league wouldn't make any money at all. And so the players organized. They organized a union in 1885 called the Brotherhood of Professional Baseball Players. And they wanted to stop the buying and selling of players. I mean, imagine if you're working in Pittsburgh and all of a sudden your owner says, well, you've been sold to New York and you can either go to New York or you'll never play baseball ever again. And they also wanted to have salaries that were market-based rather than imposed by this salary cap.
So the formation of the Players League was led by a player manager named John Montgomery Ward. Who was he?
John Ward was one of the most interesting men to have ever played professional baseball. He was a pitcher through one of the game's first perfect games in the 1870s. He was a lawyer. He got a law degree from Columbia University. He earlier attended Penn State University from Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, right near State College. He turned into a shortstop once his arm wasn't strong enough to pitch again. He ended up going to the Hall of Fame much later. And he was widely respected by players and owners and fans alike as one of the most gentlemanly, virtuous players in the game. Ward was also a fighter. He believed in the rights of players. He was a great teammate. And he basically led and started the Brotherhood, and then really was instrumental in forming the Players League 5 years later. Ward played for New York, and by all accounts was a fantastic pitcher, shortstop, hitter, base runner, really a, I guess maybe what we'd call a five-tool player today.
So clearly the players felt that they were being pushed into a corner. For them, for John Montgomery Ward, and for the players who followed him, and many of them did, they must have felt like this is our only way to assert ourselves, to assert our rights, and to gain a measure of respect with the owners by leaving them and forming their own league. Mm-hmm. How was he able to do that?
The union throughout the mid to late 1880s wanted initially, at least, just for the National League to recognize them as a union and to negotiate with them. But the National League refused time and time again, refused to recognize their union, refused to sit down and talk with them. And so the players got increasingly testy, increasingly angry at the National League. And Ward, along with his fellow teammates and National League stars, secretly formed this new league called the Players League, and basically said to the National League in 1889, well, if you won't meet with us, then, you know, we're going to find another way to play. All along, unbeknownst to the National League, unbeknownst to the fans, they were organizing this new league, finding investors to put up the money for them, securing places in different cities where they'd build the ballparks, and getting secret agreements from almost all of the National League players that they would play in this league.
Who recognized the league? Once it got going, who acknowledged it and basically agreed that this was, in fact, a major league?
Well, the fans certainly did, I think, most importantly. In Pittsburgh, for example, like most of the cities of the Players League, there were two teams, one representing the National League, one representing the Players League. And fans came to the Players League ballparks at both in Pittsburgh and everywhere else by, in some cases, a 2-to-1 margin, some cases much more. In Pittsburgh, it was astronomically more, actually, came to the Players League ballpark. The National League club didn't have the talent. And so players or fans recognized the Players League has the best players. The National League was scrambling to get basically anyone they could find to play. And so most importantly, the players recognized the Players League as the legitimate form of professional baseball. Later, historians have recognized and officially designated the Players League as a legitimate major league, along with the National League and later the American League. But I think most importantly, it was the fans at the time gave their support overwhelmingly to the Players League.
How did the owners react?
They didn't like it so much, as you might imagine. They reacted first legally, trying to prevent the players from breaking their National League contracts and forming and playing with the Players League. That failed in almost every case. In every case, there was no legal restrictions from them doing this. The owners tried in the press to demean the Players League. And ultimately, what was successful is the National League owners convinced the investors who backed the Players League to back out, because they convinced them that it wasn't going to be profitable, even though it probably would have been.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Robert Ross, an associate professor of global cultural studies at Point Park, who's written a new book called The Great Baseball Revolt about the Players League, which lasted one season in 1890 and was the players' way of making a statement to the owners that you are not treating us well, and if you don't negotiate with our union, we are going to go out on our own. What could you tell us about the Pittsburgh Burghers? They were one of the teams in the Players League. Who were the players on the team, and where did they play?
The Pittsburgh team's interesting. The most lasting legacy of that team is they built Exposition Park, which was right about where Three Rivers Stadium was. There's a plaque there. And so that ballpark that they built later became the site of the first World Series. But the Pittsburgh club, which was not didn't perform that well, but was not at the bottom of the league, about middle of the pack to lower of the pack. Ned Hanlon was a Hall of Famer who played for the Pittsburgh team, later went on to play in the National League, later went on to the Hall of Fame. Fred Pfeiffer was one of the superstars, played for Pittsburgh. So they had some recognizable stars. They weren't as good as Chicago and Boston and New York or Brooklyn, but they were a decent team and certainly a lot better than the Pittsburgh National League club.
And you say that was the preference of the fans, was to see the Pittsburgh Burghers instead of the Pirates, which I don't know if they were known as the Pirates by then or not, but they were more interested in seeing the Rebels as opposed to the established league team.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's for two reasons. One, like I said before, it's because the Pittsburgh Burghers, the Players League club, had better players. But it's also because in 1890, Pittsburgh was already a labor city, a city where people were in unions, they supported organized labor. The Players League marketed itself as a union league, as a working man's league. And fans resonated with that. There was also a strange incident where there was a marching band. Most teams had marching bands that led them into the ballpark before games. And there was a marching band that had played with the National League club that was not recognized by what eventually became the American Federation of Labor as a legitimate union group of musicians. And so to protest that, a lot of people went to the Players League club as well. So it was that combination of union loyalties as well as just baseball fandom.
So the Players League drew more fans. Mm-hmm. It made money. Mm-hmm. Why did it only last one season?
That's a really good question. It made money, but many clubs didn't actually make as much money as they spent. And I think that's mostly because it costs so much to build these ballparks initially. And so like any business, you're going to invest a lot of money to build your capital, build your infrastructure. And in the first year or two or three, you might not make all of that back. And that was the case with all of the teams except for Boston, lost more money in 1890 than they spent when you include the costs of construction. But they were on pace to make more money than the National League. And they certainly made more money in 1890, if you exclude the costs of construction, than the National League. The reason that they failed, really, is that the Players League teams were co-owned by players and by these investors whom they found to help them out. And some of the National League owners basically were meeting secretly with some of the Players League owners or investors and convinced them that this is a losing endeavor. You're not going to make any money. Let's consolidate. Why have two teams in Pittsburgh when we can have one? Why have two teams in New York when we can have one? And a lot of these moneyed men, they were not as ideologically motivated as the players. They were just out to make a buck. And they thought, well, sure, that makes sense. Why have two teams when we can have one? And so one by one, right after the season ended, the teams announced, we're going to consolidate. We're going to have one Pittsburgh team. Actually, in 1891, that's when they got the name the Pirates, in large part because they were pirating players from other teams. And Chicago consolidated, and New York consolidated, and Brooklyn consolidated. And this was great for the investors, but the players were livid. The players felt betrayed. The players did not want to play with the players who didn't join the Players League to begin with. They saw this as a capitulation. And so it was really the investors who turned their backs on the players and said, you know, we'd be better off just joining forces.
Did the owners of the established National League teams take the players back?
They did. They knew just as well as anybody that without those players, they wouldn't have a product to sell. I mean, it would be like if Major League Baseball today decided to try to form a new league without any or most of the players, no one would recognize the names, the talent wouldn't be as much. So they took them back, and actually in 1891 and a little bit in 1892, salaries went up because the teams were competing to get these players to play for them. There was another league, the American Association, that was also trying to get players to play for them. And so salaries initially went up, but then two or three years later, they went down below the 1889 figures. So it was, unfortunately, in the end, a big loss for the players.
Did the formation of the Players League, did it give the players any leverage at all with the owners?
It did in those initial years, but I think they were so beaten down and frustrated that I think it had the opposite effect, actually. If you look at salaries, at least in the 1890s and in the first decade of the 20th century, the players were morally beaten down by this and didn't really attempt to do anything like this again until, you could argue, the Federal League in 1914 was, it wasn't exactly along the same grounds as the Players League, but at least it was an alternate league, and the American League when that was formed. But in terms of a player-led movement, it didn't give the players much leverage in the decades that followed.
And, of course, I believe it was in the 20s that the reserve clause that you spoke of was upheld by the Supreme Court. And so that stayed in place for another half century or so,
mm-hmm.
until Curt Flood and other players tried to establish free agency. And eventually we got what we have now, which is the players are able to negotiate after a certain amount of years with any club, and they're making a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the legacy of the Players League? Can we say that that was the first step toward what we have today, or was it a sidestep, or maybe a step backwards?
I think it's a step toward what we have today. They were really, what they were really seeking was the same as what we have now in terms of defined contracts of 1 year or 3 years or 5 years, after which you could then negotiate for a better salary. For me, what interested me about it is I think it's still relevant, if not to professional baseball, but to professional sports and college sports, actually, more than anything. Just the idea of players creating value for an organization or for a team and not getting paid for it, or not getting paid as much as they're creating. And so when I was researching this, I started researching this when I was at Syracuse University, when they were winning the national championship and these players were world famous, and of course not getting paid a dime to do so.
Having their images used on products and having the NCAA profit from their image and their likeness, but not the players themselves.
Exactly. And I think anyone in college sports and Division I college sports certainly recognizes they're creating so much money for people and they're not getting any of it back. And I think while the players were getting paid in the 1870s and 1880s, they also recognized we're creating a lot more money than we're getting paid for, and we deserve to have a greater share of that. And I think you could even take it a step further. Anyone who works for a boss, anyone who works for a company recognizes that they're creating more money than they're getting paid for. Otherwise, why would their employer employ them in the first place? So I like to see this story as relevant to contemporary labor politics, both within sports and beyond.
It's a fascinating read. It's called The Great Baseball Revolt, a book by Robert Ross, who is an associate professor of global cultural studies at Point Park University and who joined us in studio today. Robert Ross, great thanks for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESN.